We're dealing with ruthless, unaccountable, unelected organizations that cannot be reformed. The only option is for us to withdraw and to become radically healthy, radically free, and radically sovereign. What will you do the next time the government announces a lockdown? And the response is clear: we will not comply. And it's that kind of spirit that we need across the world, because courage is contagious.
What is the African perspective on the latest developments at the World Health Organization? We're often talking about what's happening in the United Kingdom. We recently had a guest on from the United States and Australia. We've heard about different parts of the world. And in fact, our recent guest, David Bell, suggested that this is a colonialist power grab, which creates an inequitable situation with developing nations. So I'm delighted to explore this in more depth today with Shabnam Palesa Mohammed, who is a dear friend of mine. I've become connected with her through the World Council for Health. I did joke about calling her a legal whiz, but we'll actually give her a proper title today. She is an international activist, journalist, and lawyer from South Africa. She is the founder of Transformative Health Justice at and founder of SA Vares, which seeks to look at the vaccine injuries independently in South Africa. She serves as the executive director of Children's Health Defense Africa, and is a steering committee member for the World Council for Health, where we first met. Now, Shabnam is a leader in international campaigning, both looking at it up from an activist standpoint and a legal point of view. And we're here today to look specifically at the WHO power grab, but we'll also explore some of the wider issues that are a threat to our health, freedom, and sovereignty. So it's my delight to introduce you to the show, and it's great to see you again.
It's so wonderful to see you, Dan. I'm terribly excited about this interview. It's been way too long, and I just want to commend you on the excellent and consistent work that you've been doing over the last at least 4 years. Well done.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah, I've lost track of how many episodes we've done, but it's well over 1,000 now, so it's been nonstop. Many conversations, and you know, it's a learning experience. You and I kind of joked about it. Our weekends are dominated by this. Our working life is dominated by this. You know, you and I have committed to tackling these issues. It's become part of our daily lifestyle now. But on that point, I suppose it'd be very interesting to start before we go into the material around the WHO. What's your motivating force? Because you're correct. I've been doing this for 4 years now. You've been doing this for 4 years now. We haven't given up. We haven't tapped out. We're relentless in trying to move things forward. What's your driving force? What's your motivation to keep going?
I think it's an intrinsic belief in the power of the 99%, or us, we the people. It's also this willingness and this understanding that if not us, then who? If not now, then when? And I want to know that I've lived this life having made a difference in the world. I think I've always been an activist, probably since the age of 5. And these are my earliest memories. But I've been working in the human rights movement for decades now, and the health freedom movement in particular, like you, over the last 4 years. And I see the bridges and the continuity between the two. And I'm hoping to bring them together at some point where we recognize we have the common enemies, which are these financial institutions that are benefiting from both, for example, war and conflict, as well as another form of war, which is the so-called vaccines and the tyranny of these supranational organizations as the tip of the spear. And I do so from an empowered perspective. I am completely unafraid. I am unapologetic about my commitment to this movement. And I feel stronger knowing that I have allies in different parts of the world, including you.
Wow. I think if we were at a physical event, that would have roused a cheer. And I felt like, yes, yeah, applauding that. And, I'm sure my audience at home we're sharing that sentiment. Now, we're dealing with some complex issues here. You know, I admire your resolve around this and others. And because it's so complex, it's often quite hard to break down because it's multifaceted. And we're here starting point, looking at the WHO and what many are calling the power grab around the pandemic agreement, as it's now called, and the international health regulation amendments. How would you summarize what we're dealing with in a short sentence or paragraph around what these key issues are?
I think it's the legalized weaponization of health, which is what's happening through the WHO and through the United Nations, which is probably where I want to start with, Dan. It's the legalized weaponization of human rights. And I don't say this lightly. I say this as someone who had the dream of becoming the Secretary General of the United Nations many, many years ago. And I had the honor of interviewing a judge who's worked with the United Nations and said to me, I'm so glad you didn't. And not least because, for example, the UN workers have been found complicit in committing acts of sexual exploitation in countries which they're deployed to as peacekeepers. So perhaps we can start with the UN, Dan, and sort of shift the conversation slightly, because for me, the UN is far more dangerous in its agenda than the WHO, which is an agency of the United Nations. I've written an article, which you can find on childrenshealthdefense.co.za, on is the UN and the WHO, are they capable of enforcing sanctions for non-compliance? And my research tells me yes. So recently, World Council for Health held a press conference in Geneva. And the role of the United Nations, essentially during COVID-19, we know the United Nations completely failed us. We know there were gross violations of fundamental human rights. But where we're at right now, as we're focused on the WHO vote that's coming up in May on the pandemic treaty and the IHR 2005 amendments, is that in September, there are more developments around the UN's power grab. So what kind of power does the United Nations want? Standing authority over essentially a one world government. It's the following 10 areas, Dan. Pandemics. And as I go through the list, just think about how many of these are happening right now or being engineered right now to make the standing authority happen. So pandemics, wars and nuclear events, climate or environmental events, degradation or disaster, accidental or deliberate release of biological agents, disruptions in the flow of goods, people or finance, disruptions in cyberspace or global digital connectivity, a cyber attack on critical infrastructure, a major event in outer space, so that's the false flag alien attack, unforeseen risks or black swan events, and technological or scientific developments gone awry and unconstrained by effective ethical and regulatory frameworks. There they're talking about AI. So one way or another, the parasite class that essentially runs these supranationals, the United Nations, the WHO, the IMF, the World Bank, the World Trade Organization, all of it, have this plan to enforce a one world government, the monopoly of power, complete centralization, which would make our governments irrelevant. And I wish more politicians would realize that they will, in fact, become completely irrelevant and therefore have an interest in pushing back. But we're at a moment in history now where this is much bigger than COVID. This is about questioning what democracy means. Is representative democracy democracy? I don't think so. Personally, I don't vote. I don't believe in the political system. I don't want to be responsible for the decisions made by political parties. And I believe that we have to engage in participatory democracy and direct action with each other. And it starts with a great sense of awareness and a desire to take our power back.
Yeah, agreed. I mean, what a transformation of perception around the United Nations. You know, you've gone from wanting to be the Secretary General in to now effectively describing them as the parasite class. What do you think really changed? And I wonder, I think growing up as well, I looked at these organizations, and I don't know if it was because I was too young and didn't know about the way the world works at the time as a child, or whether the organizations have genuinely been corrupted over that period in time. I'm 40 years old now, and you know, as a child, I looked at the UN and the WHO favorably. You know, I could see the work being done in Africa. That was always the example we got to see in the United Kingdom, which may have been absolute propaganda looking back now. But I'm curious, do you think the organization has radically changed from when you had that dream? Has it been corrupted? And is that really the root of the issue here? Or was there a deeper attempt at grabbing power right from the outset, do you think this started with noble aims and became corrupted, or is this just a natural trajectory that it was always destined to go on?
I think it's both. It comes out of a World War II era, and there are two sets of people around the UN. One would genuinely believe in the United Nations as a construct and a platform for international cooperation and peace, which is failing dismally, right? And Einstein said, if you do something expecting the same result, it's the definition of insanity. Then you get the others who actually utilize the UN to grab more power for themselves in direct and indirect ways. And if you look at the funders of the United Nations, including MasterCard and the usual suspects, it's the same who are funding, for example, the WHO. And the clear example of where the United Nations completely failed us is during the COVID-19 chapter. So I've been involved in co-creating a legal brief called Preventing the Abuse of Human Rights Through Public or States of Emergency, essentially, which you can find on worldcouncilforhealth.org. And in this legal brief, we lay out the four international human rights law criteria that governments and us have to know and consider and analyze before even thinking about declaring a state of emergency. So what are these four criteria, Dan? One, the threat should be actual or imminent. And think about COVID, right? Actual or imminent. Two, involve the whole nation. Three, place the continuation of the organized life of society at risk of extinction. And four, be so extraordinary that ordinary measures for protecting public health and order are clearly inadequate. None of those criteria were met during COVID-19. And neither the United Nations nor the WHO pointed that out. Neither did either of those bodies criticize the pharmaceutical industry like Pfizer, whose contracts with Latin American countries and South Africa attempted to institute a clause that would hold as security for that vaccine debt the country's military, embassies, and reserve banks. Essentially, the sovereignty of a country. Did any of these organizations speak out? Absolutely not. And that's why we say they're being managed or run by the parasite class, the noble people inside aside. And so that's where we're at. And I think geopolitically, we're seeing countries question their role within the United Nations and the WHO. But the WHO, the African 47-nation bloc in 2022, opposed amendments to the IHR on the basis that they were rushed, not inclusive, and posed a threat to sovereignty. Since then, the WHO has appointed two members to its executive board from Africa, right? So it's the carrot or the stick that they use for power and influence. But the United Nations also tried in September last year, and I say tried because they did so unlawfully. They behave unlawfully, both these organizations and others. They tried to declare a political declaration on pandemics then. At least 11 countries broke the silence and wrote an articulate letter to the president of that General Assembly that was 78 in September last year, objecting and laying out their reasons, including but not limited to the lack of inclusiveness, the lack of transparency, the lack of certain countries being seen as on an equal footing to others, which has always been a problem. Security Council is a pointed example. That letter was completely ignored, and the UN General Assembly's president went ahead and declared that the political declaration had passed. So we're dealing with rogue organizations, in fact, that are willing to break the rules to further their agendas, including the WHO, which doesn't care about its own four-month rule to produce documents to member states 4 months in advance before they're voted on. So that tells you we're dealing with ruthless, unaccountable, unelected organizations that cannot be reformed. The only option is for us to withdraw and to become radically healthy, radically free, and radically sovereign.
I love that. Yeah, I think when people are asking about what the solutions are, you know, there is always a spectrum, and I think there's the optimist who thinks that they can be reformed and kind of restored to some sort of historical form of glory. But the corruption runs so deep, you know. Even if you, with the WHO, for instance, remove private funding sources, it's the same. You know, when you look at the political elections, there's some interesting political leaders that have emerged in the last few years. I know there's divided opinion on Robert Kennedy Jr., but for instance, if he was elected, he would have to remove 30, 40, 50, 100, 150, 200 people from key departments to kind of remove the kind of deep-rooted corruption within the kind of political agencies. And I think the same is going to be true with the UN. It would need radical overhaul. And so it's the corruption is so deep within these entrenched organizations that actually to reform would be complex. So I'm with you on this need for alternatives, and also to bring it back to that individual journey, which is the kind of heart of what the Road to Geneva campaign that we're working on is all about. It's about that personal sovereignty, personal freedom, that declaration. But we're here to talk about your role in this. And I'm curious, what's been the political and public response in South Africa to these developments? You've mentioned sort of the wider rejections from Africa, the African bloc as a whole, but what about South Africa specifically? How have they responded to the WHO?
Well, there's been a complete lack of public participation, like in most countries, actually. But in a, you know, in some good news, we've had a debate, our first debate, in fact, in Parliament. When I say we, I don't mean we the people, we a parliamentary debate, of course. And it was interesting to note that it appeared that as if there was no critical thinking around the potential implications and risks involved in these agreements. So the motion was led by the ACDP, who I helped prepare for this this debate. Apart from other initiatives that I've taken, serving PIA applications and all of that, which was not responded to by government. And so the other political, the ANC is sort of the majority party in the country. This is a country that was part of helping our country arrive at democracy after the dark days of apartheid. But make no mistake, we may have dealt with race-based apartheid, was still dealing with economic apartheid, which is led by the corporations that pilfer our mines, etc. So endemic levels of poverty. So the ANC, and I'm making posters around the position of each political party because we have elections coming up. The African National Congress is going to listen to the WHO bottom line. They see them as the leading authority, know very little about the WHO's workers committing sexual exploitation on the women at the DRC, for example, or the other failures with regard to the opioid crisis, the tobacco scandal, the nuclear disaster, etc., etc. They seem to know very little. So that's the ANC. Disappointing, to say the least. Then there's the economic freedom fighters, who raised the very pertinent point that the Health Portfolio Committee was never consulted on the IHR amendments or the new pandemic treaty. And they're seen as sort of the rebel upstart party within the political framework of the country. So I'm hoping that they will realize that, in fact, what is happening is medical colonialism and corporate imperialism, and then decide to take a stance against what is going on. Then, of course, the ACDP, which led the motion, and they were very clear on what the WHO is doing. It is, in fact, a power grab. It is a threat to sovereignty. And in particular, I would say Article 12, Dan, which is always the one, forget everything else. That's the one that's really standing out to me, where the Director General of WHO, Tedros, who is seen as a terrorist in parts of the world, including the Ethiopians that I've interviewed, would have the unilateral authority to declare public health emergency of international concern, whether your country agrees or not. This is a dangerous, dangerous geopolitical weapon. If the handlers and funders and benefactors of the WHO don't like what your country is doing, the position that your country's government and or people are taking, it is so simple to then say, we suspect we might have some sort of pathogen there, but not only pathogen, or climate change events happening there, or any range of what they deem to be public health emergencies. It's very much a very broad and very open-ended. So we recommend that you shut your country down. If you are sitting with leaders who are corrupt, they'll do it. And they will subvert, for example, protests against the government. So it's a very dangerous geopolitical weapon. And then, of course, there's the DA, the Democratic Alliance, which is seen as the opposition to the ANC, which kind of has this, we'll wait and see, we'll take action when we need to approach. This is, of course, again, extremely dangerous. What's also interesting, Dan, is that we have discovered that the IHR 2005 amendments were never properly ratified in our country in 2013. So we have a massive loophole there that we can work through. There's also research that has come through from the people's lawyers, who I believe are based in the UK. They've discovered that, number one, the WHO's formation in itself was unlawful. And secondly, signatories to the constitution at the time of formation were not officially mandated to sign those documents. So there's so much to think about in terms of the unlawfulness of these organizations, but they keep us so busy in this paper war. Oh, look, that amendment has changed slightly. And as a lawyer, I understand completely every word matters. For example, the word shall is a legal instruction, right? And these documents are pulled with your country shall, the member state shall, the person shall, right? The WHO shall. But I don't want us to be stuck in forever being absorbed in these documents and not looking up and seeing the broader picture and deciding what we're going to do about it. For example, our constitutions may need to be amended. Section 231 of the South African Constitution is around international agreements. And while it does include a requirement, almost a public participation, it's not mandated. It's almost a nice to have, which is a far cry away from the Freedom Charter that our country fought for. So I'm advocating for Section 231 of the Constitution to be amended to, one, make public participation mandatory, then make a parliamentary process mandatory before any international agreements are signed. And I think that is the approach we need to take. We have a saying in Africa, nothing for us without us. And we can say this because in Kenya, for example, Dan, and you might have watched the film Infertility, A Diabolical Agenda on CHD TV, it documents the WHO facilitating an experiment on Kenyan girls and women only. They were told they were getting tetanus injections. These injections were laced with HCG and rendered those girls and women infertile. So Africa is very well aware that it is used as a hunting ground for the pharmaceutical industry. But not only that, agriculture, World Bank, etc. And now with the formation of BRICS, which I'm not saying is perfect and the all-in solution because we don't have a seat at the table, but it certainly does represent a shift in terms of multilateralism and countries examining whether they need to continue to belong in these organizations that have no respect for much of the world.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that you say that. I think, you know, these new power blocks that are arising, you know, they certainly do come with pros and cons, as you alluded to. But it is a form of decentralization of the global power structures. You know, I'm often thinking about the G7, the G8, or the EU, and you know, they're often so lockstep on so many things that I would fundamentally disagree with that it feels difficult politically to challenge. Yet there is a new power block that is willing to challenge those groups. But essentially, we're still playing the battle game through either elected or unelected bodies that are thoroughly disconnected from the people and rarely have a democratic process. So it leaves us still in this kind of puzzle, but a slightly more diluted version of it. So it's tricky, but at least it's at some form of potential positive step that we're seeing these new blocks arise. Now, with Africa as a block as a whole, you've spoken on it several occasions through this conversation that there's been objections and there's been obviously very notable abuse of power within African nations, particular reference to pharmaceutical companies, in fact, indeed their funders as well, the likes of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, also notorious in that area. Is there a potential hope, therefore, in May when these documents go to the vote at the World Health Assembly that the African bloc could actually carry a lot of weight? Is there a sort of consensus or a belief that Africa is a line of hope for the rest of the world who are concerned about these documents?
Well, I'm certainly driving towards that. I draw great hope from the fact that World Council for Health Japan held a massive rally about a week or two ago. I don't think you saw the footage. It was thoroughly inspiring. But I do hope that the African nations remember who we are. And that not only do they make reservations or vote blank against these amendments and the treaty, which we can do, at very least, we should be advocating to delay so that there is an actual public participation process. But of course, that's also dangerous because they will engage in more corruption and more threats and things like that. It's also why I drafted a bill, the Exit the WHO bill or WHO withdrawal bill. It's a 3-page bill, which you can find on my website, shabnampelesamohammed.com. And there are at least two political parties in South Africa that have accepted this bill like internally and have promised to mobilize around it. I intend taking that bill forward to an event coming up in Africa. I'm not going to say which country this month that I have been invited to participate in. It is a high-level event, and I intend to advocate fully for Africa to withdraw from the WHO and to maintain its dignity and hold her head up high and establish new ways of working in international cooperation with other countries who themselves want to extricate themselves from the oligarchy. There's also a film, Dan, that we've been working on here in South Africa. It's a 2-part film called WHO's Global Power Grab. We've released a preview to part 1. It's a 9-minute preview. I do hope your audiences are going to watch. And not only does it uncover and unpack the most important themes, not only like who is the WHO, where are the conflicts of interest, who is Tedros, how did he get all of his power? Talk about the IHR and the treaty. What about censorship? What about the ethical politicians are speaking out? And what can we do to take our power back? So for me, what makes this feel different is that it spotlights those politicians who have been speaking out. There are at least 100 health freedom advocates that are featured in this film. So I would certainly urge your audience to watch and realize this film is coming out of Africa. So you will see more content, more people in that film from the African continent, which is exactly where we need to be. The oligarchy needs to realize that the threat comes from everywhere. And that's how we threaten them, you know. I honestly believe what we're facing is organized tyranny and a form of terrorism. COVID-19, the psychological warfare, was a form of terrorism. And many people are still terrorized into compliance. But interestingly enough, when I talk to everyday people, Dan, taxi drivers, domestic workers, security guards, you know, salt of the earth people, and say to them, what will you do the next time the government announces a lockdown? And the response is clear, we will not comply. And it's that kind of spirit that we need across the world, because courage is contagious.
I agree. And I think it is one of the stepping stones that's required. And I thoroughly agree with what you said about this kind of international stat, taking an international stand and showing these oligarchs that it is a global resistance. And that's, again, the road to Geneva. We've had people, we thought this would be a European campaign, but we've got people calling us from Canada, New Zealand, Australia. You know, they're not going to be able to drive to as part of the convoy, but that they'll be able to join us. And the same is true with African nations. It's amazing to see. And I think you've highlighted a really important point as well, because part of the underlying issue that I see here is this one size fit all centralized policy. Yeah. So even if you're looking at it with very little background awareness of the kind of power grab elements here or the corruption, surely one can see that, you know, the needs of the African states are very different. I mean, just look at the geography. It's completely different. Look at the terrain. It's completely different. Look at the culture. It's completely different. Why would you deploy the same policies? So even if you're just purely looking at it from a policy standpoint, it makes almost zero sense that a central organization is so remote from the local territory. And you could say the same for the United Kingdom. You know, we're a very distinct small island. You know, we have very different characteristics than other parts of Europe. Yet we have this one-size-fits-all, as we saw during COVID, policy that becomes lockstep, creates a massive groupthink and group identity around these things. It becomes almost an impenetrable force that people can't break free from. Of course, we saw people like Sweden and other countries that did reject this. And indeed, we saw some African nations rejecting these things as well, which was really fascinating to see. But this, to me, on a very basic level, is surely that the average person can understand that just trying to apply a global health policy to to a very different set of circumstances makes absolutely no sense. What would you say about that?
That health is being weaponized as the tip of the spear. They were looking for some way to gain control over us, and then they launched COVID-19, and our corrupt governments went along with it. Perhaps some of them were ignorant, others are just, you know, plainly corrupt, and are making themselves completely irrelevant in where we're headed to with this one world government, right? We're not going to need national governments. Politicians will become unemployed. But the reason they're also targeting Africa in particular, I think Africa did particularly well over the COVID-19 chapter, from rates of infection, rates of recovery, but also very low rates of comparatively of the vaccine uptake. And so Africa, therefore, is a fertile ground for them to entrench themselves even further. In fact, I've commented on a story written in the published by The Defender, which is a CHD publication. What they're trying to do in KwaZulu-Natal in South Africa, which is where I live, the province in which I live, they're actually paying for research. The NIAID, I believe it is paying for research for some researchers in the UK to develop a behavioral psychology model to convince children and their families in rural areas, which means poor, to take the HPV shot. Now, that is racist. It's violent. It's colonialism in action. And so they have these various schemes, for example, like, oh, we'll set up this mRNA facility in your country and we must all applaud when they're cutting the ribbon. It's a death sentence. mRNA technology is not safe. But they provide funding for research for HIV AIDS and TB and mRNA and cushy positions and, you know, becoming a spokesperson or whatever, the WHO or one of its minions. And so that's how they get away with, in fact, capturing a country's health. And so we have to, as the African continent, stand up. One of the advantages we have, Dan, is an abundance of traditional, natural, and indigenous medicines, which the majority of our people used during COVID-19, including, but not limited to, Artemisia. Its African name is Omhlonyane. My apologies. And so even those medicines, the pharmaceutical corporation is on a mission to colonize. In fact, Tedros was in India last year. India has a whole ministry. India has a whole ministry called the Ayush Ministry, dedicated to traditional, natural, and indigenous medicines. And so he went there to sort of promote the WHO's interest in this medicine. And we know that he's there as an errand boy of the pharmaceutical industry. I mean, let's be honest. So part of our work has also got to be to turn away from allopathic medicine as a way of disenfranchising and disempowering the pharmaceutical industry. The other has got to be canceling those vaccine debt contracts. We had a case here in South Africa. The HJI, Health Justice Institute, took the Department of Health to court for those contracts to be released. And of course, the terms were shocking, including but not limited to the clear clause that says that Pfizer makes no guarantee about safety and efficacy. And yet we had government, corporate media, and NGOs, which are being funded by these same, you know, multinationals and whatnot, Gates and whatnot, to keep drumming this message of safe and effective. And I would say that's got to be a priority. I think countries around the world should use what we found here in South Africa in those contracts to have those contracts cancelled and to demand that your country signs no contract without your informed consent.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I think there's lots of interesting conversations across the legal population now around, particularly since the recent, it was small and the fine was insignificant around Pfizer's marketing, something like $30,000 or something ridiculously low fine. However, now people are saying that, well, if you fraudulently represented your product and that's now been proven in court, then, well, does your liability claim still stand, or your indemnity still stand? So there's some really interesting developments on that front, and I agree that, you know, we need to look internationally for those exceptions that can be utilized globally. So I think there's a lot of hope moving forward, and I'm sure you're the same with everything you're doing. We will continue to move forward irrespective of what the WHO vote for in May. You know, we want to send a message that whatever they choose, their vote will be obsolete in our eyes. We're going to continue to move forward and develop new solutions, new pathways, so that they become irrelevant, and we march on a whole different beat. We're nearly out of time, but I'm just curious, just what would you send as a kind of closing message of hope to people watching at home, and indeed to people within Africa that are, you know, concerned about these developments? I'm very curious what your fundamental message is for the longer term here.
An injustice to one is an injustice to all. Take injustice personally and see systemic injustice, not the ones that you feel are only committed against you, but realize that the ones that you are not seeing or that seem to be behind that matrix affect you very personally, and we have to get involved in pushing back. The kind of world they're trying to take us towards, this transhuman organized tyranny, is one that's going to affect our children and our children's children for generations to come. But we are extremely powerful. It's why they talk about us and they say there's this group or this movement engaging in disinformation. It's because they're nervous. Tedros is now trying to recruit young people to counter our so-called disinformation on the front lines. But the film I talked about, the WHO's Global Power Grab, my 18-year-old had a look at it and said, I understand. I understand exactly what's going on here, and we need to do something about it. So there are ways of reaching each other. We're also seeing massive anti-war protests happening around the world, led by young people. So I think ours is to also help the young people understand the tyranny of the pharmaceutical industrial complex and the organized tyranny through the WHO, the UN, etc. I think they're starting to see it. We do have a common enemy. But as always, Dan, the power of the people is greater than people in power. If we truly believe in that, and if we wake up every day thinking, what can I do today to move towards health, freedom, and sovereignty, we would have already won. Don't let anyone divide and conquer us. Do not get distracted by celebrity culture or some other mundane distraction. Keep your eye focused on this better world that we are co-creating.
Amazing, Shabnam. This has been an incredibly powerful conversation. Thank you so much. You've shared a lot of resources. We'll put all the links into the description of this episode. So if you heard about the film and the various different papers that have been discussed, you'll find all the links below. So check that out. Thanks very much for watching. Please hit that share button. Thanks again, Shabnam. This has been incredibly powerful. Great to see you today.
Thank you, Dan.
Welcome to Free Humanity. I'm inviting you to join us on the Road to Geneva, our exciting new campaign to resist the World Health Organization. The Road to Geneva campaign will culminate in a pan-European convoy that's going to converge outside the city of Geneva on Friday, the 31st of May, ahead of a peaceful rally outside the United Nations building on Saturday, the 1st of June. If you want to join us, head over to roadtogeneva.com. You'll find out about our latest convoy plans and the wider campaign to challenge the WHO, and I hope we'll see you on the road to Geneva.